It's Wednesday, July 6th, 2011, and you're listening to episode 238 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 49 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name is Pat.
This is Wayne.
And my name is Chad.
And this is Chris.
This is Michael.
Michael is the gentleman who won our March of Dimes charity auction and won the right to be on an episode of Fear the Boot to pick the topics and all that stuff. So, Michael, I want to welcome you to the show.
Howdy.
I also want to thank you very much for supporting a great cause and a great charity. And it is more than our honor to give away this very simple and degrading gift as in return for what is hopefully a great, meaningful cause.
Yeah, you should have held out for better.
I'm glad to be here one way or the other.
A spot on this mic is worth all $5 he paid for it.
Gen Con coming up here in just a couple weeks. Two quick reminders on that. First off, once again, Fear the Boot is this year sponsoring This Just In from Gen Con, which is a media play-by-play of the convention. I will link that in the show notes. If you want to hear some great live coverage of Gen Con, interviews with the personalities that are there, announcements regarding game products and other stuff, that's going to be a great source to get it from. If you are interested in joining us, once again, the Toft Bitch Network with our games and dinners and all the other silliness we do is up and running. And this week I have the link to the Con Planner site. If you want to be on the Toft Bitch Network for this year, be sure to get signed up on the Con Planner site. So Zeke has your phone number so he knows how to text you to tell you where we're going to be. And also for some of the events, it's my understanding that he needs headcounts. So be sure to get out there and check that out. One other quick thing before we dig into the show at hand. There is a media service, which I was just introduced to a couple weeks ago by Wayne. Wayne, where is it you found out about this thing?
Kevin Smith's podcasts.
Kevin Smith's podcast. All right. So take that either as a geek cred or a confession, depending on your view of Kevin Smith. But there is a service out there called Stitcher. When you first posted something called Stitcher, I thought you were referring to my City of Villains character.
I forgot about that.
What Stitcher is something like Pandora for talk shows, podcasts, and AM/FM radio, where basically what you do is you put an interest or a show you like, and based on that, it builds a playlist around that show. And Fear the Boot just got accepted into it. And so I'm going to put a link to our show on Stitcher. And there's two things that I'd like to ask that you guys as our listeners do. The first off is if you're interested, take a look at Stitcher because you might find some great content on there that you enjoy apart from Fear the Boot. Now,
Party.
I was about to say it's highly unlikely, but Chris just cut me off. So.
Chris is listening to the High Fiber podcast now.
I am not old.
The life after 60, millennia. The other thing I was going to ask is if you go out there and take a look and decide that Stitcher is not for you, if you could at least give our show still a thumbs up and a star on there, the two types of positive ratings, we would deeply appreciate it for a simple reason. That helps us float to the top so other people can find our show, which builds our listenership. So it's a 30-second thing you can do. Go out to the show notes, click that one link, click thumbs up and star, and you're done. If you check out Stitcher, you might like it. If you don't like it, we would still at least really appreciate your guys' help in getting the word out about Fear the Boot. Alrighty, so let's dig down to the topics here at hand. First off, Michael, let's go ahead and tell a little bit about you. For starters, while you are from, was it Bozeman, Montana, you said?
That's right, Bozeman, Montana.
Okay, you are not currently living in Bozeman. Where are you living right now?
I'm living in Osaka, Japan at the moment.
All right, let's go ahead and get the obvious questions out of the way. Are you affected by the tsunami or any of those other events? You know Americans in geography, so let's just get this done.
Right. No, actually, Osaka was completely unhindered by the earthquake and the tsunami. We were very lucky. No damage, no injuries whatsoever. You couldn't tell anything happened here for most of the time.
And you're working over there as an English teacher.
Yes, I am. I teach English in junior high schools.
How did you land a job as an English teacher in Japan? What is the career path there?
Well, I studied Japanese and German in college, and a friend of mine introduced me to the JET program, which I think is how a lot of people come over here. It's teaching in high schools, junior high schools, some elementary schools. And so I signed up for that, and I got the job, and they sent me to Osaka.
Now, do you have a degree in English, or is simply being born a natural English speaker is considered sufficient?
Knowing the language is enough. If you have a college degree.
Okay. So I did want to ask you, you said prior to recording, there's not a whole lot to say, but nonetheless, I did want to ask you anyway, just since we have you on the mics, what is tabletop gaming culture like in Japan? I mean, we see a lot, obviously, from Japan in terms of anime, manga, video games. But what is tabletop gaming like over there?
You know, I really don't have a whole lot of experience to go on. Like I said, I found some Japanese D&D books, and I mentioned in the middle of nowhere at a used bookstore, I found a second edition copy of Shadowrun in Japanese, but I've never sat down at a Japanese game of D&D. Frightening to think what it might be like.
In Japan, it's pronounced Shadowrun, isn't it?
It's the only game Chad will hate from right to left.
So have you managed to find a gaming group over there?
No. I play with my coworkers every so often, but none of them are actually gamers. It's pretty barren, which is weird because they're
just other bored expats.
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, there's no shortage of nerds here, but...
Now, you said that you had found some books. So I have a question in regards to those. Is Oriental Adventures over there just called Adventures?
I wouldn't know.
Go out and ask. Yeah, it's your last week there. This is the type of question you should be asking when getting deported. Doesn't matter anymore. Chris, there is a topic that you suggested on the forum, which Michael has agreed has legs. So since this is his show, you know, we're letting him run things here.
Absolutely.
So
I don't have anything interesting to say, don't worry.
Yeah, neither do any of us. But that doesn't stop us from putting out 5.5 years of crap. But Chris, I was wondering if you want to go ahead and set up what it is we're talking about.
I recently had a conversation, I think it was on Facebook, and it had to do with... Somebody had made the comment that made me think about Dungeons and Dragons. It has kind of a double-edged sword reputation where a lot of people within the hobby, you know, are more than happy to deride it or to, you know, have edition wars over it and all this kind of stuff, or say they don't play it and just have some derision for the game. But yet when it comes to having to describe to those outside of the hobby what they do, they always have to, because of the name itself, they always have to default to, well, you know, Dungeons and Dragons. Yeah, that's kind of what I do. But then, of course, they have to, you know, usually they'll immediately follow it up by saying, well, yeah, but I don't really play that. I play a different game. But they need the name of the hobby to help people outside the hobby identify with it, you know, kind of like Kleenex in a certain sense. But they need the hobby, but they're not necessarily maybe very happy with the game and where it's gone.
It's just a simple case of fat beard rage.
Well, that's kind of where I was going to go, is I wonder if it's not so much an issue of people trying to distance themselves from the game as the image. Chris is right. If I walk up to the average normal on the street.
I love it.
I know. I hate to go there. But anyway. But if I go up to the average person on the street who's not a gamer and say, name 5 role-playing games, they're probably not going to get past 1.
Final Fantasy VII will probably be the first answer you get.
Okay, well,
That brings the other part of the fact, and we don't even have to get into this, but the fact that video games have essentially co-opted RPG, and that means something completely different now.
Yes, I completely agree, and maybe that's another banter topic for another time, or maybe we'll get to today, I don't know. But if I walk up to the average person on the street and say, Wayne, to clarify my point, name 5 pen and paper, pencil and paper role-playing games.
That's the phrase I use, either tabletop role-playing games or pen and paper.
And they're probably...
They'll probably say... My daddy's an alcoholic. I was touched in a bad place or something like that.
We didn't say go talk to strippers.
Well, you know,
I mean, I would
psychological counseling,
there.
You do a lot of role play.
So, okay.
Now you play alcoholic daddy. How does alcoholic daddy hurt your feelings? And then you role play that out.
Show me on the pewter dragon. No, but I think really the average person could probably not name a title beyond D&D.
And I was going to say, actually, I don't think many people would know what a pen and paper RPG is necessarily.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so if you're trying to shorthand what it is you do, you have to fall back to D&D. But then instantly, the average person also in the here at D&D conjures up these negative images of either A, completely socially inept people hiding in their parents' basement at 35 or 40 years of age, or B, Satanists killing each other in steam tunnels. And so you have to pretty quickly back away from that and say, I play role-playing games, and truth be told, I may even be in a D&D campaign right now, but I totally don't play D&D.
Well, part of the problem with that is, too, and I don't even know if it's really the problem, but part of the issue is the name itself. There is no other real game that kind of encapsulates what tabletop RPGs, for the most part, are about than Dungeons and Dragons. You know, you can say, yeah, I play Pathfinder, and they're not going to have any visual representation of what that is, but yet everyone can visualize a dungeon and a dragon.
See, for me, the game doesn't even come up in these conversations. People say, well, what's your hobbies? And like, I don't look at them, you know, my beard all quivering with drools coming down my lip and cat piss all over me. I say, I play D&D! You know, it's like, oh, well,
Let me tell you about my wizard.
Yeah, it's like, well, see, I'm a well-rounded, healthy person, and so I have a variety of hobbies. I play video games, and I watch a lot of movies. I watch a lot of foreign films, too. And, I also do this podcast. I play a lot of board games and stuff, and I also play role-playing games. Oh, role-playing games? Well, if they get past the board games, what do you mean, like Candyland? No, more the Euro-style games. They're kind of getting popular now.
They usually get stopped at the podcast level.
Yeah, podcast level is a good stopping point, too. Well, what's the podcast about?
Exactly.
Well, it's about role-playing games. What's a role-playing game? I usually hit them with, it's like, think about it like telling a story. You and your friends get together and you tell a story, and then we make a game out of it. Really? How do you do that? Boom, all these questions. You keep answering their question, answering questions. You don't have to say D&D. You guys are absolutely right. D&D has too many connotations to it, and I think the game is lame. They're not paying me a nickel every time I say D&D. otherwise I'd be wearing the t-shirt and banging the drum. It doesn't even need to come up because
that's right.
It's not because I, God, that's a disturbing mental image, but
it's not even mental. You've seen it.
That's true. It's not because I hate D&D or anything like that. It's just like, it doesn't need to be part of the equation. I'm trying to tell them about my hobby, and D&D is just this tiny facet of a larger experience for me.
It would be very much like saying, I'm a big movie buff, but you can't say that. You have to say, I watch Citizen Kane.
Yeah, I watch movies. What's a movie? You know, Pulp Fiction? Oh, Pulp Fiction. Now, every single movie is Pulp Fiction. Of course that's not true. Of course that's a ridiculous thing to do. Same thing applies for role-playing games. What happens, though, in reality, is I start down this path of not saying D&D, and then they go, oh, like D&D? Yeah, I used to play that. Oh, really? You did? Yeah, when I was 13. And then, that's the end of it.
You know, this isn't unique to role-playing games either. I see it a lot with comic books. Mm-hmm. When people say they read comic books, they always immediately follow up with, but I don't read superhero books.
The hell do they read then?
There's quite a few non-superhero books.
Jared. The dirty ones.
Oh, right.
Pornography.
Wait a minute.
I personally don't get it. I mean, if the need to distance yourself from the thing that is the cornerstone of your hobby, not necessarily that the hobby's built around it, but that people outside of the hobby recognize it's the face of it. I don't see the need to distance myself from that.
When I first met you and we talked about comic books, I said that. I'm like, I read comic books, but I don't read superhero comics. Because I didn't read superhero comics. You have, in the meantime, introduced me to some wonderful superhero comics. I mean, I'm talking spandex and capes and all that sort of stuff. But it was true. At the time, I didn't. Comic books as a medium is kind of coming up as an art form. I mean, when you have stuff like Sandman or Persepolis or...
The Boys?
Well, no, that's not an art form. That's just... I would never call The Boys art. I would never call anything...
It's beautiful, unbridled brutality.
Yes. But Mouse is another one that... There's a lot of people who have never read a comic book, but they've read Mouse.
I've heard of English classes and such that assign... Or history classes that assign Mouse reading.
It's wonderful. It's a wonderful comic book.
Walking Dead would be a good example of that as well. I mean, there's clearly that is not, by any stretch of the imagination...
Nobody's a hero in Walking Dead.
No, nobody is at all. And I don't know, I don't necessarily feel like I have to distance myself. You know, when I use that shorthand term of D&D, you know, that maybe gets them into the hook of just, you know, trying to understand what I'm explaining to them. And I may almost take the reverse of Chad's approach, where I start with that, but then back out and explain more of what happens and other games that I play, because saying that there's a, you know, quite a variety of ones out there. You know, you can play them almost any type of genre you can think of, and go on with that kind of thing. And that's worked fairly well for me. You know, yeah, it's unfortunate that it still has, even after all this time, some of that negative connotation to it.
I mean, it seems to be a matter of just breaking the stereotype. But in my life, I've been stereotyped so much that I have no problem, you know, starting with the stereotype and breaking breaking away after that.
You're filthy.
It just saves time to ask someone, have you ever heard of D&D?
Soulless.
Exactly. But I think Chad's approach really is, honestly, I would say a more correct approach to take.
I agree.
Not that I want to say that Chad is correct, but in this particular instance, he, you actually do have it right on the money that probably is the best way to approach it.
Yeah, we're taking the lazy way out.
Totally. Well,
Mike, I have a question for you, because you teach English in Japan and you're around a lot of Japanese people. Mm-hmm. Has it ever come up in any conversations that you play role-playing games, you're trying to explain this to a Japanese person? Is it something they get, something they care about, or something that just has never come up for you?
You know, I don't think that it's ever come up, no. I did once try to show a Japanese person how to play a role-playing game, but for one, even if you speak fluent English, it's kind of a difficult concept to grasp.
Right.
It doesn't translate very well, I guess. But like I said, they have the books here.
Are you saying that you weren't successful?
They got the idea, but it didn't really play out very well.
Very agreeable, very polite, and got out of there as quickly as possible.
Yeah, they pay you to teach English, not role-playing games.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, so before I get back to this D&D topic, I got to ask, what is the strangest question you've ever been asked? There's got to be a good one in there somewhere.
Let's see.
I mean, just the most wild American stereotype sort of question that anyone's ever asked you.
Big one comes up is, do I eat bread with every meal?
Do we eat bread with every meal?
Japanese people think we eat bread 3 times a day with every meal, like they eat rice.
A lot of people do.
Well, it's a strange one. I was expecting, how many guns do you own? This was
I get that one too, yes.
You're from Montana, so I'm guessing the answer is not zero.
Enough.
He's not going to talk about the cache that he has buried back in the yard. You know, the militia's strictly forbidden him to talk about that.
Next to the Montana militia, the Osaka militia is the most dangerous one. Okay, so getting back to the D&D thing, I got a question for you guys then. Let's say for a minute D&D did not exist. You get to pick which game would you want to be the stereotype, archetype, and face of our hobby.
Dread.
Okay, Chad picks Dread. Wainard?
I honestly don't know. I've only played homebrews. Skies of Glass.
Okay. Wait, are homebrews on the table?
That's fine.
If homebrews are on the table, homebrews are on the table.
That's fine. Okay, so Skies of Glass. All right.
Lucid.
Lucid, okay.
Because I want royalty.
You want royalty.
I want them to make the Lucid movie, which they already have.
Yeah, they called it Inception, and it got Lucid made.
Yeah, I want, like...
All right, so we'll go back to Dread, because... Pat?
BattleTech.
BattleTech? You've never even played BattleTech, have you?
Yes, I have. My God, I played BattleTech.
When did you play BattleTech?
I played...
And just because someone hasn't played BattleTech with you, doesn't mean they've never played BattleTech.
I would love to play BattleTech with you.
Well,
I played BattleTech growing, back in Springfield.
John and I may have been plotting just such a thing when he was last up here visiting.
Awesome.
But I can't talk about that too much, because that is topic forbidden.
I've never played it as an RPG.
Michael, what about you?
I would say it'd be better not to have one stereotypical RPG.
I agree with you, but if you had to pick one, which would it be?
If I had to pick one.
You had to pick one.
Jeez, I honestly don't know. We'll say GURPS, because I used to play a lot of that.
GURPS, okay. Chris?
Virtual.
I'm sorry, when you say GURPS, I would imagine to an outsider that would sound like some sort of bodily function.
I always think
could be worse. I almost said quags. How does that sound?
I always think GURPS sounds like a grape soda brand. Yeah, give me a bottle of GURPS.
Or baby food.
Yeah.
GURPS was the first RPG anyone ever handed me, and I had no idea what an RPG was. So I'm looking through this GURPS light book, had no understanding of it whatsoever, just put it back in the desk.
Well, because GURPS is pure system. There's no set.
Yeah, you're right. Actually, that was a bad answer, because if you looked at GURPS without knowing what an RPG is, it would scare the hell out of you. Never mind.
D&D at least has an implied setting.
Right.
I'm not sure GURPS even has that.
I was playing RPGs a year before someone mentioned the name GURPS again, and I remembered someone handing me this, like, that's what that was.
That's fun.
Because I had no idea. I didn't understand it.
Huh.
I would stay with the old school stuff, and I would either go with Tunnels and Trolls or RuneQuest.
Root? Wow.
Yeah.
Reaching way back there into the dusty old drawers.
And I would, you know, and I would do that, I guess, from that standpoint of having to try and pick something that is vaguely descriptive of at least a good chunk of, you know, what happens on a tabletop.
Well, that's the funny thing. As you described this, you gave that as an example of why D&D was good. I've never played in a game with a dragon, ever. I don't think I've ever been in a dungeon, ever.
Actually, there was a dragon in the Last Guy's Glass game you played. Okay, I totally made that up. There was no dragon in the Last Guy's Glass game.
I just didn't get to see him, that's all.
If I had to pick one game, this is actually going to be a somewhat, I don't know, maybe for me an unusual choice, I'd pick Spirit of the Century. And the reason I would is because of the fact
that... It has a gorilla on the cover?
It has a gorilla and a biplane on the cover.
There you go. No,
it's because of the fact that the game encapsulates really two things. Adventure that does not take itself too seriously, and infinite possibility. The stereotype it carries with it is almost a lack of stereotype. And that's why I think I would choose Spirit of the Century.
Because I also love aspects. Any game that's going to be...
Because it's so descriptive. It doesn't conjure up... It's like a Rorschach test. It doesn't conjure up any image except whatever image you want to conjure up yourself.
See, you guys are all thinking too low. I still say Lucid. Because I want to be the Gary Gygax of gaming. I want to be on Futurama instead of saying, hi, it's Roll, nice to meet you. It's like, hi, it's, and then I take a block out. Nice to meet you.
I survived meeting you.
That's right.
So now everything's a bit more tense for some reason.
That's right.
You know, I would actually, someone mentioned on the forums wondering what a Skies of Glass game would be like with Dread. If the right story was being told in it, that could be the most incredible thing
ever. A survival post-nuke game in Dread would have to be very carefully done, because it's not per se that each problem builds upon the prior problem. Each problem kind of stands by itself, so you would definitely need a certain type of plot, like a political situation where a city is collapsing and on itself through and fighting or something.
One shot would be incredible.
Yes, exactly. All right, so let's move on from that to our main topic for today, which was picked out by Michael, and therefore I'm going to make him set it up. So, Michael, go ahead. What are we talking about today?
Okay, well, a little bit of introduction. I'll be going back to America soon. I want to get back into gaming. And,
hooray!
You know, I've been listening to your podcast for a while, and you have this collaborative world-building stuff. And it sounds really good to me.
Yeah, Chad's slowly coming around to it.
We'll get him yet. And one thing I was thinking of is I usually GM, and one of my favorite parts of being the GM is making the villain. I love a good villain. So I thought, well, do collaborative world building, get more player buy-in. What about collaborative antagonist building? Get everyone to create the villain or their opposing organization.
When you sent that email to me, I was immediately intrigued because of the fact that my entire experience as game mastering, I have seen a wide variety of collaboration. I guess beginning first with collaboration on the protagonist design via the group template, even though when we first started using it, we didn't per se call it collaborative design. That's really what it is you sit down and agree as a group that everybody's character is going to fall within certain parameters, have certain connections, have a reason to be together, and which obviously requires collaboration and agreement. But I never once contemplated collaborating on the villain. Even in the years where we went through times where we collaborated on the setting, where we might be playing a homebrew, but someone would add something onto it, and we'd accept it as canon. All the way up to our current campaign, where Chad outright told us, I want you guys to write certain portions of the world.
Like all of it.
Like all of it, so you can be as lazy as possible.
That's right. And then Wayne gets to drive me to the game. And I can use technology to roll dice
and
for
then
me.
And Pat grills the brats for you.
That's right.
And I bring the wine, and you don't have to...
What do you do?
Nothing!
Oh my God!
And this is the best campaign you've ever had.
Awesome. This campaign Chad is doing has nothing to do with, has not touched, is the best we've ever had. I'll let you, the listener, work that one out.
I'm a freaking genius. That's what it is.
But what I was thinking about is, why have I never done this? And I think there's one simple reason, but I don't know that it's a sufficient reason, which is that to me as the game master, the one thing that I have to control for the sake of entertaining the players is the plot. And by control, I don't mean like railroad, but I just mean, you know, create and reveal. And the center of the plot is the antagonist. And since I tend to wrap my antagonists in a lot of mystery and misdirection, and who you think is the bad guy may not really be the bad guy, there might be a power behind the power, that letting the players get together and design their own villain would be the antithesis of everything that I have held dear about game mastering. But the more I thought about it, I don't hold to that anymore. I think this has actually been a rut of mine that, I mean, not saying like throw away forever, but I shouldn't hold to, like...
I'm loving that idea, by the way. I mean, I've never done that either, but to be honest with you, I think the potential that's there is, you know, is amazing. Now, I guess, you know, for me, because Chad would be the first to point out, I kind of like to, you know, have a little bit of control over things and don't want to let my players run too roughshod over everything I've done. But to have their input with the foreknowledge that what they're saying may or may not be true to help keep that sense of mystery, you know, as they go forward, I think really it just adds a lot. And there's a tremendous amount.
But if you're enforcing a veto right, then how much is it really collaborative design anymore?
Well, because I wouldn't say necessarily it would be a you could get away with saying it's not a flat out veto. Maybe it's a modified veto in the sense that, yes, it's true, but it may not be true because of this reason that you stated.
Chris, are you on Fear the Buddha running for office right now?
He wants a line item veto on this.
Well, I'm saying, yeah,
it's totally a veto, but it's not a veto.
Yeah.
Because you're still allowing it, but maybe just not for the motivations that particular player listed.
You have to give Chris some kind of credit here. I mean,
okay.
Chris is, and not to, this is going to sound insulting. I don't mean it as such.
Sure,
yeah, he does.
Maybe a little. You're not fooling anybody, Chad.
Chris runs a game, and correct me if I'm wrong, where it's his game that the players are taking part in. I run a game where it's not my game. It's all of our games, and we're all taking part in it. And for Chris to come out and say, you know what, I would be willing to have the players design the big bad, the motivator behind all of the events that are troubling the players, I would let the players collaborate on that. I think is a big step for Chris. I mean, that's quite a bit. That's actually pretty cool for someone to basically loosen up like that.
We're so proud of you, Chris. You've come so far.
Apparently, I've entered a whole new world. Though I do think that one thing for sure that I like to try and accomplish in my games is building as much player investment as I can. And that with whatever plot that I have, you know, sketched out, questions of the players answer before the game about their character, I need to work the answers to those questions into that plot. So as they go through, they find things to connect themselves and create more motivations for themselves to stay in what they're doing or to really want to accomplish, you know, whatever the goal may be. And this, to me, really is just, it's another tool that can be used for that. I mean, a bad guy can be a bad guy, can be a bad guy, but they want to throw some of the elements in there that as to what makes that bad guy that guy. I'm all for that. I think that's a fascinating idea and a worthwhile experiment to give a shot at.
As a player, I don't know that I would want to create the big bad guy. I love the idea of creating bad guys for the game, minions or other bad guys you're dealing with, but the main antagonist, that to me is something I want to discover during the course of the game. I think in my case, I know everyone doesn't feel the way I do, but in my case, the game would lose something for me if I started the first session and knew who the bad guy was, knew the bad guy's motivations, because a big part of role-playing games to me is discovering that story, discovering the characters. And I like the mystery of, is this bad guy or a good guy?
I would say, look at it this way, though, Wayne. If your character goes in there and you know, essentially 1/4 or 1/5 of the story behind the big bad, but you have no idea what the other characters might know, and vice versa, and they have nothing that you know. Discovery of those other elements would be part of that. Yeah, you might know some, but that's some right there. If you have the right approach to it, that's part of your character's hook for being involved in the first place. You know, because I think that should be an integral element. If you're going to design the big bad, you need to contribute the reason as to why your character is involved in this. There has to be some connection between you and the big bad somewhere, and it would be up to you as a player then, if you're going to contribute that factor.
And I would say it's good to paint with very wide brushstrokes when you're doing the collaborative villain building. You don't have to give the villain a name, or you don't have to design his childhood, but just an idea of what his themes are, like what are his ideals and his goals. And you can leave the more detailed details to the game master.
Yeah, I would be very cool if the GM came to us and said, do you want a big bad guy that you can fight with your fist at the end, or do you want a puppet master that's pulling strings? What type of villain do you want?
Let me, I totally agree with what you guys are saying, that there are layers to this, or shades of gray, that you don't have to design it all or design nothing. There are certainly steps in between where you can say, I want this to be a single person who works through brute force versus a multi-layered international conspiracy.
See, now,
but here, let me give you another example, though. When you went to see Dark Knight, you knew exactly who the Joker was. I mean, you may not have known precisely what Nolan and Goyer's take was going to be on him, but you knew generally who the Joker was. But nonetheless, it was an enjoyable movie because of the fact that doesn't mean you know what the Joker was up to. And in the same way, I think that a group could sit down, and in the same way you write your character, but that doesn't mean you foreknow everything that character will do in the course of the campaign. You can completely create the villain, but it doesn't mean you know what the villain's plot is.
Yeah, and I think that that's very important. I mean, you guys are saying it's like, oh, well, if the players create the character, then that removes a lot of the mystery. I agree. If that's the case, that's a big downer, especially if mystery is important to your campaign or important to you. Some campaigns don't have any mystery. But here's the thing. The mystery of the game does not need to be embodied within a person.
Yeah.
So, well, think about this. Think about Sherlock Holmes. Sherlock Holmes knew everything there was to know about Moriarty, but he couldn't move against him. Moriarty tried to kill him a whole lot, and there's this big back and forth battle there. Tons of mystery. It's freaking Sherlock Holmes, right? Tons of mystery, and you knew who Moriarty was, or at least Holmes did. And it was revealed to you as the story went on. I think that you could play a game like a Sherlock Holmes type game, if Sherlock Holmes didn't exist, where the players can create the Moriarty villain and his big network. And the mystery does not come from the character of the Moriarty. It comes from all the stuff that's going on.
And to expound on that, I was also going to say that if you have a villain where knowing this villain instantly gives you the knowledge of what this man, woman, or organization is going to do, all their motivations, what they're going to do, and how they're going to do it, that is a really monodimensional, crappy villain.
Yeah.
Well, I think if you look at like movies or TV or video games, we generally know who the villain is. I mean, we get scenes where it's the villain at home talking about his plans with his lieutenants, and that doesn't ruin the story for us. It gives us a better idea of the villain's motivation. It gets us more buy into the story. So I think in that same way, knowing something about the villain going in gives you more of that buy-in.
Yeah, you know, what this really conjures up to me is, it reminds me of like if you're sort of playing in an established setting, a Star Wars or the DC Universe or something like that, where you know about basically the big bad guys because you know the stories. But it's still fun to play in the in that world because, like you're saying, there's all this kind of thing that even though you know everything there is to know about Darth Vader or the Emperor, you still don't know what they're going to do, and they're going to have these plots. And at the same time, I like this idea because here, not only is it you know about the setting, but it's not some setting that you had nothing to do with. You've really got, like what you're saying, you've got the buy-in because your group made up the world and the bad guys. So it's like, to me, that seems even more cool because this is something that we did. We collaborated and we did. So now it's more special to us as opposed to everybody knows about the Joker or, you know, the Emperor or whatever.
You know what a bad villain is? A bad villain is somebody who at the start of the story thinks certain things and has certain motivation and has a certain personality, and who at the end of the story has the exact same motivations and the exact same story and the exact same everything. He just gets defeated. And that is a terrible villain. It's a terrible character. You wouldn't play your character like that in a role-playing game. So I think that you can collaboratively make this villain, and if the game master plays that villain honestly, the actions of the player in this world that is evolving and changing and moving forward
Can evolve the villain.
Mm-hmm. Or, you know, and I think that that would be awesome to see. And that would add to the mystery. Because I want to see how this villain develops.
Well, and that's something that I think
can
about
we
this.
Talk the villain out of it?
That's something that I think as we develop this just becomes, I don't know, more and more at the forefront of my mind is we've talked at Fear the Boot a lot about the group template, designing the characters to be coherent, to be interconnected, mm-hmm. to be, you know, there's some level of collaboration in building the group that you play. And the villain, because of the fact that they're a major part of what you are about to set out and do in the world, is a big part of that. And so if you guys sit down and say, look, we are together for a variety of reasons that have this shared history and these things in common, and this is why we stick together instead of going our separate ways. And on top of that, here is the guy that represents the antithesis of everything we stand for. Here is part of our motivation to keep moving forward in the world. And in a strange sort of way, suddenly the bad guy becomes a part of the group cohesion or the mm-hmm. group itself in this really through the looking glass sort of way. One of the things I want to mention is the fact that this entire exercise presupposes good intentions on the part of your players.
Of course. Because,
I say this ought to be obvious, but let me go ahead and expound on it here for a moment. Anyway, there are people out there who, when they're told you can create the villain, are going to create someone with obvious panic buttons, or what they're going to do is throughout the game, they're going to abuse that out-of-character knowledge to go after every weakness this person has. They're going to bicker with you about, wait a minute, what I had in mind wouldn't do this or behave that way, and turn into a setting lawyer with a game master. And so this really does presuppose good intentions on everyone's behalf, that the players are not going to abuse this knowledge to their advantage and are also not going to constantly be trying to beat the game master up every time this villain manifests in a way that doesn't seem exactly like the one they came up with. But conversely, this also does presuppose that in order not to completely invalidate the contribution of the players, that the game master will make an honest attempt to be faithful to the villain as created. And this is where I'd encourage game masters, look, if you need layers of plot and layers of mystery that directly involve the villain, but you want your players to collaborate on designing that villain for the reasons we've talked about, group cohesion, added buy-in by the players on the plot, etc., etc., then find ways to have that villain do unexpected things, or to end up being interfered with by villains the group didn't design, or by, as Chad described, evolving as the game evolves and reacting to the things that the players do and changing in ways that they didn't foresee, even though this is still the person or persons that they envisioned at the very start of the game.
It's about trust.
Exactly.
It's always about trust. You got to trust your game master to run the villain well and to run him truthfully. You got to trust your players.
Yeah.
That if the players are programming in panic buttons and doing all this stuff to defeat the villain within the first couple of games, ask yourself, what is it that the players want? They don't want to beat the villain in the first couple of games. They're looking for a very specific kind of experience that isn't being delivered to them. Not that I'm saying that what they're looking for is good or right or what you're into, but you have to ask yourself, it's like, do they need more combat? Do they need bigger challenges? Do they want to take on bigger and badder things? Maybe you should throw that at them and add that more into the mix. But it's all about trust. If you got players that are screwing you over like that, you got to have the conversation with them.
You know, the more I think about this, as nervous as the idea made me think originally, there are some characters that I think you could build better knowing what the villain would be. Mm-hmm. For example, you can't have Captain Ahab if you don't know about Moby Dick.
Yeah.
The character is based around that obsession. You could have something like that in your game. This is a character who has been slighted by the big bad. He's devoted his life to this, and now he has to get past that as he tries to kill him.
Well, yeah, I think this is something that players have been doing for a while. I mean, you make your own character background, and it has characters who can be used as villains, who may be used as the main antagonist or side antagonist. It's just really more of an expansion and then group collaboration on that same idea.
Yeah, and that is something that I have done extensively in my history as a game master, is I have taken NPCs, they'll mention their background, and brought them up as antagonists, but never really as the main antagonist, the main plot. And I think that's the jump that I'm not going to force myself to take, because tools in the toolbox, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, this doesn't have to become the way you run every game. But this is something that if I find the right occasion, I might try experimenting with or jumping into. One of the places I think this would work wonderfully is something that I believe, Michael, you were mentioning in the pre-recording talk, and I was saying was exemplified by the Champions MMO, which in the Champions MMO, and I've actually never played it, but from Wayne's description of it, when you create your character, you have to create your antagonist.
At some point down the line, you do.
Nemesis.
Yeah, your nemesis or whatever it is.
So your arch villain, your nemesis, or whatever you want.
So if you're creating Batman, at some point, just as you went through character generation to make Batman, you eventually have to go through character generation and decide you're going to make the Joker. Okay, you know, or whatever the case might be. You make your ice guy, so you make your villain, you know, Heat Torch Man or whatever.
Sounds like an awful comic.
It does sound like an absolutely awful comic. In fact, I'm holding a corkscrew in my hand and thinking about self-lobotomizing just to fix that. But I think superhero games and superhero stories in general are a great example of how this idea can work.
Well, yeah, with superheroes, what's more defining than their supervillain, their arch nemesis? So say have each player design their own arch nemesis or even design another player's arch nemesis.
And they're also usually tailored to complement or contradict each other in a very intentional way.
Yeah, Spider-Man fights other animal villains.
Exactly. Yeah. Superman is an alien with all these impervious powers and super strength and whatever. So who's the guy he's fighting? A really intelligent human with the one thing he's weak to. The Batman's crazy, so who's his villain? A guy who's a twisted reflection of his own insanity. On down the line, you know, the villain so wonderfully complements the hero and in a sense defines that hero, helps to bring out the aspects of that hero. Now, when you deal with a role-playing group, you're not necessarily talking about a single character. You're talking about many characters. But look, that group is going to have a culture. It's going to have a politic to it. And if you design the villain right, you can help bring that out. If you have a group that loves doing investigations into cold case files, then great. You have a villain who's extremely good at covering his tracks, you know, or who loves emulating killers from the past or something like that. You find some way to make that fit in perfectly with what this group already has its eyes on.
I really do. I kind of like that idea. As you're sitting here describing it, especially the one where you're having each player describe their arch nemesis or arch nemesis, depending upon how you want to pronounce it.
Your patness of the day.
Correctly.
Your patness of the day. Exactly. A lot of it depends on the scale of the tabletop that you're in. If your characters are all, you know, people from a small town who have yet to go beyond the world, you know, you got to be cognizant of that and how, if they're going to describe their arch nemesis, which is, you know, the guy who runs the tannery down the street. You know, you might have to broaden your horizons a little bit or try and do some creative storytelling to expand it beyond that, you know, or maybe wait until they've gotten outside the city limits before they even come up to that process of contributing and designing their nemesis.
I love the idea of players creating each other's nemesis because I think the best supervillain for any particular hero is somebody who can punch their panic buttons and they can punch his panic buttons. That duality there needs to be there. And it's a lot easier to do that if someone else is looking at your character sheet than it is if you're looking at it.
What a great superhero. The superhero I'm playing, his name is Panic Button. And his only ability is that he knows the panic button of anyone he fights.
And he can punch.
He's a good teammate. He's bad in solo. Yeah.
But in the moment of psychic connection where he learns that panic button, the other person learns his.
His panic button is that he is a normal guy with virtually no powers.
This is a Palladium game.
Oh,
it's a massive fear of boats.
That's right.
One of the other things that was brought up in the pre-recording conversation, we've talked in past episodes about jumping into NPCs, that if you're in a tavern and your character's not there, then to keep yourself involved in the game and interested in the game, that maybe you take on the role of playing the barmaid or playing the drunk guy at the next table or something to that effect as a way of keeping you involved. And we talked about, you know, the layers of trust and the boundaries that go into that. One of the things that we had somewhat set off limits was playing villains. And we hadn't set it totally off limits, but we said you have to be really careful with it for the simple reason that in many cases, especially if you're talking about the primary villain or the lieutenants of the primary villain, you may not know what these people are like, what motivates them, what the Game Master has in mind for them. But if you choose in a game to experiment with this concept, this suddenly opens that up. When the main bad guy shows up, whether he's on or off the table for play based on your GM's preference, then certainly his lieutenants, his henchmen, these start to come into play because now Well, you may not know this person's exact plot. You do know generally how they tick. You may not know exactly which building the Joker is going to blow up, but you do know what kind of mind he attracts. And so you can start to jump into roles that may have been otherwise off limits for that kind of branching out.
And related to that, Dan, you know, one other offshoot of that type of approach, you could have the players design the nemesis for the other players. So that when that time comes around, you know, basically the GM is just going to step aside and let the players, in the sense of somebody running his character and somebody running the enemy, go at it. And you just act then suddenly as just nothing but maybe a die-rolling facilitator.
You know, I have no idea how it would work out, but if you're in a group that likes variety, I think it would be interesting to have you do 2 weeks of these characters. Now, the next 2 weeks, you're playing these characters that are antagonists to each other.
Oh,
there's not necessarily good guys, bad guys. They each have their own point of views. And you just switch back and forth campaign-wise.
Wayne, that would be a fascinating campaign that could either go wonderfully or explode spectacularly.
Exactly.
Either way, you win.
Yeah, either way, it would be an interesting exercise to see what happens if we create two groups of characters that are either one's good, one's evil, or they're just diametrically opposed. They're, you know, one's from this country, one's from that country, and the two countries are at war. And you play out the campaign until they converge, and eventually one side has to win.
Exactly. And then you get the buy-in from the players on both sides.
Yeah.
So you don't want to kneecap the other team, because the other team is you, too.
You, too, but at the same time.
You know, one of the interesting ideas that comes out of this sort of collaboration on the villain side that that Michael's brought up, at least that I have thought of, is that what it can allow the GM to do is to provide some of that, the narration that you get in a lot of other media, like movies and or books, you know, from the villain perspective, that is conveyed to the audience through his conversations with his minions or whatever, that obviously the heroes do not have. So you could actually, you know, in doing this, you can have the GM play the main bad guy, and then your other players can jump on as his trusted lieutenants, and he has this meeting of the minds about what he's going to do or whatever. I think that could be a really cool way to convey to your players a little bit of knowledge other than just by saying, or, you know, well, you just wouldn't say it, but that's just something that it's lacking in normal play. I think that'd be fun to experiment with, like you're saying. That
could be really cool. Something I do want to stress there is, this is something that we're positing as a cool idea. I don't think this is right for every group. I don't think this is right for every game. I'm not saying this is even something I would attempt to do in my next game, but it is a really cool idea that I could see working out well in the right situation. And for people that are looking for kind of new and strange ways to take their game, I think that this is a wonderful idea. And I appreciate Michael for bringing it up, for giving us, you know, this entire concept here to play with.
Oh, you're too kind. I am a genius, so.
Oh, he fits right in.
Hey, you said it online. It's true now.
That's right.
All right. Well, Michael, I want to thank you for joining us, and thank you also for supporting such a great cause that hopefully, you know, will go on to help a great many people.
Oh, happy to help.
As for the rest of you guys, I just want to remind you once again to check the show notes for links to This Just In from Gen Con, to the Toft Bitch Network for Gen Con for all the games and stuff we'll be running there, and also to our show on Stitcher, so you can get out there and show us some love. And I want to thank you guys all for tuning in, and I hope you have great games and you will join us the exact same time next week.
Later,
see
games.
Yeah.
Nothing here? Nothing at all?
No, I was giving a dramatic pause. We were collaborating.
That's
on the
right.
End.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2011. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.